Reveal is brought to you by Progressive. Are you thinking more about how to tighten up your budget these days? Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average, and customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts when they sign up. A little off your rate each month goes a long way. Get a quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed in 2020. Potential savings will vary. Discounts vary and are not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja, in for Al Letson. Every week you tune into this show, we bring you some of the best investigative reporting. The stories we tell take months, sometimes years, to nail down. And when we finally publish those investigations, we couldn't possibly fit in everything. I think that's why Al ends the show with, "There's always more to the story." So when we have more data and records than we could possibly fit into a story, we share those leads with local reporters who can. And that's what this week's show is all about. The small publications and local reporters who are making big waves. And I wanted to start with one of my favorites. It builds on something my colleagues worked on a few years ago. In 2019, Reveal found hundreds of current and former law enforcement members who joined online hate groups. In 2020, a rookie reporter from Louisville reached out to us and asked how many Kentucky cops were in these groups. We knew of 4. But he had a scoop that bigotry on the force was not just being expressed online, it was being taught. And his story sparked a scandal so big that the governor had to respond. So let's start there.
Hello. I hope everybody is having a safe election day, but we are still fighting this worldwide pandemic.
It's November 3rd, 2020, and Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear looks tired. He's doing a socially distant COVID briefing from a podium flanked by flags. He's wearing one of those navy blue zip-up jackets that governors in the movies always seem to have when they're touring disaster sites.
We're going to get through this, and we're going to get through this together.
At the time, COVID numbers were surging here, just like they were almost everywhere. But at this press conference, reporters had another question.
Hey, Governor. Can I ask if you asked for Commissioner Brewer's resignation because of the incident with the training manual? And have you become aware of any other incidents in which such material may have been used?
The previous week, a story broke about a Kentucky State Police training slideshow. This slideshow, which they showed to more than 100 new recruits, featured a quote from Adolf Hitler. It also urged officers to be ruthless killers.
With regards to the commissioner, he submitted his resignation.
After the story published, Commissioner Rodney Brewer, a longtime veteran on the force, stepped down.
So we are conducting a top-to-bottom review of training materials. We have identified at least one other PowerPoint that appears to contain some of the same information from the same...
The reporter who broke this story didn't get to ask any questions in this press conference. In fact, he hadn't even been invited. Maybe that's because he's a teenager.
My name's Satchel Walton. I'm 17 years old. I'll be a senior next year at DuPont Manual High School in Louisville.
Satchel looks a little bit like he stepped out of a Wes Anderson movie. He's got a fedora, long hair, round glasses, and he loves the news. Satchel, along with his younger brother, and co-reporter Cooper, wrote their first story for the Manual Red Eye, a high school newspaper, and it was a bombshell.
Under fire and under scrutiny as Kentucky State Police are under the spotlight.
Congressman John Yarmuth tweeted, quote, "As a Kentuckian, I am angry and embarrassed, and as a Jewish American, I am genuinely disturbed that there are people like this."
When I caught up with Satchel, he was sitting in the same place he'd spent a lot of time reporting. His unfinished attic, under support beams and fluffy tufts of insulation. When they make your story into a movie, the coming-of-age story, Where do you think it would start?
It was complete luck, really. My father is a lawyer, and one of his partners had a case about a police shooting in eastern Kentucky. He got, through discovery, a presentation from the Kentucky State Police in which they quoted Hitler. And my dad texted the family group chat and said, "Oh my God."
How'd you know that this was something you wanted to dig into?
It was just an instinctual reaction. You can't be quoting Hitler in a police training. That's insane. I couldn't believe it when I first saw those images. I thought they must have been photoshopped or something. I've got the whole slideshow here. Let me see. They've got this American flag and bald eagle in the background. Here we go. We've got this quote: "The very first essential for success is a perpetually constant and regular employment of violence." Quote Adolf Hitler. It attributes it right there.
Whoa.
Yeah. And that's not like something nice that was said that just so happened to have been said by an evil maniac. That was something Hitler said that is like, you know, sounds like a core tenet of fascism.
Okay, so you get this blockbuster tip. And what do you do next to make sure that it's true? I think my first thought would be like, no way that that could be a part of a police training.
Well, the first thing to do was to look at the data on the slideshow itself, on the file, and look at when it was created, look at who created it, and that seemed to line up. How do you make sure that with your non-professional news outlet that no one's ever heard of, how do you verify that everything is correct?
Are these steps things that you instinctively knew how to do, or were they things you had to learn as you were doing them?
It's definitely not something I would have known how to do if Cooper and I hadn't been in a team and on a bunch of calls with the Red Eye editor and with the advisor.
Satchel says one of the big things missing from the story was a quote from the Kentucky State Police.
And then eventually the spokesperson, he said, "The quotes," referencing the Hitler quotes, "are used for their content and relevance to the topic addressed in the presentation. The presentation touches on several aspects of service, selflessness, and moral guidance. All of these topics go to the fundamentals of law enforcement, such as treating everyone equally, service to the public, and being guided by the law."
Are you kidding me?
No, that's the original quote.
Oh, no. He defended.
Yeah, no, that, and that's the basically the whole thing. He didn't condemn it and say something better, but yeah.
You upload the article, and then what happens? You get to like splash some cold water on your face and take a walk around the block?
Yeah, that was basically the plan. I told a friend of mine who lives a couple blocks down the road, asked if she'd wanted to play a card game at the park on Friday afternoon. And I just wanted to think about something else and relax for a little while. But unfortunately, my phone kept ringing, and it was one of the advisors saying, "Satchel, you got to check your emails, answer your phone. The governor's spokesperson wants to talk to us and get a quote now."
Satchel, can you tell me, like, watching this story go out into the world, what does it look like from where you're sitting?
Once Martin Luther King's daughter was tweeting about it, once Maggie Haberman, White House correspondent for the New York Times, was retweeting the article, I was just shocked, excited, and knew it would demand a big response locally. October 30th, we published the first story about Hitler quotes in the presentation. A couple days later, November 2nd, we published a short piece that the Kentucky State Police Commissioner Rodney Brewer had resigned after 33 years.
This is a guy who's been in the Kentucky State Police for somewhere around twice as long as you've been alive.
Yes.
And he steps down as pretty much a direct result of your reporting.
Yes, as a consequence of these articles, he is forced to step down. And the spokesperson who gave us the original statement defending the Hitler quotes still works with the Kentucky State Police, but has been reassigned.
And then you didn't stop there.
No. Someone who works within law enforcement anonymously contacted us about a Kentucky Department of Criminal Justice training that had used a clip from an anti-Semitic neo-Nazi film company and included a Nazi logo in it.
Okay, so to recap, there's one training slideshow that quotes Hitler, then there's a different law enforcement agency in the state that uses a symbol from neo-Nazis in their training video. Sort of feels like too much Nazi stuff to just be a coincidence. It leads me to think that maybe there's some kind of affinity between Kentucky law enforcement and the hate groups that are whistling to them.
Maybe, and it's not too high-pitched of a dog whistle to put Hitler quotes in there. That one's pretty obvious.
That's right. That's true. Yes, it is. That's a foghorn. Satchel and his team keep reporting. They publish 5 stories about the Nazi logo, Hitler quote, and quotes from Confederate General Robert E. Lee, all used inside training materials. Eventually, Governor Beshear agrees to talk with the paper.
Thank you for meeting with us.
Thank you for doing what you do.
Satchel and 2 student reporters join Beshear on a Zoom. Feels like half interview, half trip to the principal's office. But in this case, the principal is the one getting grilled.
And I'm in my nice little hat, green jacket and white shirt in an unfinished attic that doesn't look quite as professional and presentable, but that's all right.
Our first questions are about the video we recently published an article about with the Nazi symbol at the start. Is DOCJT's investigation determined who included the video yet?
Well, DOCJT is still looking top to bottom.
On the call, Governor Beshear promises a top-to-bottom investigation. But more than half a year later, Satchel tells me they still don't have answers to some fundamental questions.
We'd still like to know how long trainings like this were used. We'd still like to know what the approval process within the Kentucky State Police was like and how the state's top-to-bottom investigation is going or did go or if it ever happened or started or existed.
Why do you think this story took off the way that it did?
Louisville had been the site of lots and lots of protests and conversations about racial justice and about policing in 2020 because it was where Breonna Taylor had been shot in March of 2020 by the Louisville Metro Police Department. And so within that context, I think there is a special awareness of the sort of issues that this series of articles discussed about policing and racial justice and hatred and bigotry in this case.
So what do you take away from this experience?
I think that this series shows that it's shocking enough that there's one guy within the Kentucky State Police who somehow, some way, thought it was acceptable to include quotes from Adolf Hitler and from Robert E. Lee. But it's even more shocking, perhaps, that there were 120 people, at least, who saw Hitler quotes in presentations, who were training to be officers with the Kentucky State Police, and who didn't speak up about that, who didn't file a complaint, and this somehow went on, and the culture accepted it for multiple years.
I understand that you have received a type of honor from the state, and that you're a governor's scholar. Involves an academic program where you will meet the governor?
Yeah, so the Governor Scholars Program in Kentucky is a sort of summer camp for what they say the best and brightest kids in Kentucky. I applied for that program a couple days after the first article was published, so I casually dropped as one of my achievements that I published that article that got the state police commissioner to resign right at the bottom of the resume there.
If you do run into the governor at the governor's scholar program, you think he'll sneak in a question?
Yeah, how's that top-to-bottom investigation going, buddy? Yeah, maybe so. It's a good idea. Maybe I will.
Satchel, it was an honest-to-goodness pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for having me.
We followed up with Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. He told us the Kentucky State Police finished its internal investigation. Now, all sworn personnel are required to participate in new trainings about racism and have completed an online course about the Holocaust. After a review of all their training materials, they said they didn't find any more Hitler or Robert E. Lee quotes. Reveal's Bayard Duncan produced that story. Coming up next, the CDC tried to stop evictions, but in some places, that didn't happen.
It'll be the judgment of the court that restitution will be issued in favor of the plaintiff for failure to pay rent.
Kicked out of your house over Zoom. That's next on Reveal.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. Odoo's suite of business apps has everything you need to run a company. Think of your smartphone with all your apps right at your fingertips. Odoo is just like that for business. But instead of an app to order takeout or tell you the weather, you have sales, inventory, accounting, and more. You name the department, they've got it covered, and they are all connected. Join the 6 million Odoo users who stopped wasting time and started getting stuff done. Go to odoo.com/reveal to start a free trial. That's odoo.com/reveal.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja. This pandemic is unprecedented in so many ways. Felt like every day, especially at the beginning, I was hearing about something new that didn't seem possible. And one of those things, a ban on evictions. First by Congress in March, then later the CDC stepped in and widened it. And I remember thinking, they can do that? But there it was. Section 361 of the Public Health Service Act, a temporary halt in residential evictions to prevent the further spread of COVID-19. Now, that eviction ban is about to end. And millions of people can soon be taken to court for failing to pay their rent. But as it turns out, in some states, evictions have been happening all along, including in Ohio. In Akron, one of the state's largest cities, at least 786 evictions were granted from April of 2020 through mid-June of this year. The hearings were held on Zoom, and the magistrates running them were sometimes churning through 15 or 20 cases a day.
We're going to need to move quickly because I do have multiple other hearings this half hour. So if we can get directly to the points that need to be made.
Reveal fellow Noor Hindi was watching. It was September of 2020, and the infection rate in Akron was continuing to rise.
I would wake up every morning at 9 a.m., open up my laptop, and watch until about noon.
The connections were spotty, and often the renters didn't show up.
The defendant is not present in this courtroom here today. As service of this cause of action was proper, and it is now 10:55, we will proceed in the absence of the defendant.
And when they did show up, it was almost always without a lawyer and without knowing their rights.
Do you possibly know anything that I could do or should be doing to maybe help me to stay in the house? Because I have nowhere. I'm waiting on the money.
I can't give you that advice. I know you may be able to call 211. I don't know, Ms. Hindi, if you want to refer him to anywhere. Do you know of anywhere he can go to?
Ms. Hindi is Noor Hindi, who's joining me now. Hey, Noor.
Hey, Ike.
So this judge is asking you to give the man who's about to be evicted advice?
Yeah, it was really weird and sort of shocking because I'd not been asked to speak during a court hearing before. But this man seemed like he was really in a panic and didn't have a lot of resources available to him. So the magistrate did ask me to step in and help.
Were you able to help?
Yeah. So I visited him at his house and found out that he was a senior citizen who had been paying his rent with Social Security for years. But he said that there was some kind of glitch in the system and that his money wasn't coming in. And so he got behind on his rent. And like a lot of people I saw, he didn't know about the moratorium.
So this was happening a lot. I understand you watched 132 hearings in the fall. How many of those people were actually evicted?
About 70% of those 132 hearings were cases where people were evicted. And something I noticed is that most of these tenants showed up by themselves without a lawyer. And on top of that, the hearings were really fast. Most of them were over in like 10 minutes or less. So imagine trying to represent yourself in that amount of time. And this is what happened to this woman named Amber Moreland. I thought that she would be the perfect candidate for this eviction moratorium. And if it was going to work for anyone, it should have worked for her.
What was it about her that made her the perfect candidate?
So Amber is, 39 years old. She's working at a nursing home during the pandemic. So she's an essential worker. And she'd lost part of her income because of the pandemic.
Seems like she should be covered.
It seemed like it, and that's why her case was so shocking to me.
So, did you follow up with her?
I did. I visited her house. I, set a note aside because she wasn't home, putting my name and phone number. And a few days later, she called me, and she herself was really enraged at what had happened.
Did you feel like you were able to testify properly?
No.
Why not?
She didn't hear nothing I said.
So, Ike, before we delve into the hearing, I really just want to tell you a little bit more about who Amber is.
Please do.
One of the first things to know about Amber is she's working with some of the most vulnerable populations during the pandemic. And when I meet her in her home, she's living in one of these houses that really wasn't kept up to date over the years. And she's there with her 15-year-old son. She loves this home at first, and it has this big backyard.
It had a fire pit, and I don't know, it was just a clear, open view in the back. But what I didn't like is it was old and needed to be redone.
She soon realizes that the house she lives in is managed by a landlord in Akron who has a reputation for renting rundown homes to low-income tenants.
It'd just be water coming in. Not even drips. It was like literally water coming in my room. In so many words, it looked like the bathroom walls was crying. The hallway walls did the same thing.
So she's living in this dilapidated house and kind of dealing with it. And then what happens?
So things escalate for Amber at this point. The pandemic hits. She's on the front lines. She's watching COVID rip through these nursing homes. And she says she was working in this lockdown ward for COVID patients, just watching one after another die. And at some point, the nursing home tells her she's not allowed to work at multiple facilities for fear of spreading the virus from one nursing home to the other.
Once the pandemic happened, I got pulled into the nursing home, and they told me that I basically had to choose. Since my mother was at the nursing home at the time, of course I chose the nursing home.
So her mom was living at one of the facilities that she was working at?
Yeah. So this is May of 2020. Amber's mom is in hospice. She's got a lot of different illnesses, including a heart problem. And a few months later, she dies. And this is a big loss for Amber.
I could call my mom and tell her about anybody. Of course she would, after me and her get done talking, tell everybody in the family. But it was more or less like she was my actual best friend.
I think this remembrance encapsulates Amber's love for her mom and how she really felt that this was her best friend and her rock in the world. It was somebody that she could always lean on for support and humor and comfort. It was really hard for Amber after her mom dies, but she keeps going and she knows she has to figure this out. But she's no longer working multiple jobs. She's losing hours and money. So she's calling legal aid. She's calling 211. She's learning about the moratorium and that she can apply for rental assistance. And she's also calling homeless shelters because she's expecting at this point that she's going to lose her home. And even though she can't afford her full $800 a month of rent, she's still making partial payments to Gary Thomas. He's listed as the property manager, while his son, Lee, is listed as the landlord.
As much as I could, I made sure, like, if I got any piece of change, I gave it to Mr. Gary. After I did for my kids, like, I'ma never let my kids go without. Because we've been down that road before. So I'ma feed my kids. I'ma make sure lights, gas, and electric is on in here before I give you something.
So isn't this where the moratorium should have kicked in for her?
Right, but here's what happens instead.
Mr. Thomas and Ms. Moreland, can you both please raise your right hands? Ms. Moreland, can you please raise your right hand, ma'am?
It's raised. My screen won't come. It won't come up on my screen.
Well, that doesn't sound like she's off to a good start.
Totally. And let me just step back and walk you through this. This is really high stakes, and it's on Zoom, and the magistrate is in one Zoom box. Gary is in another Zoom box. His attorney is in another Zoom box, and Amber is alone talking to them through the speakerphone of the magistrate's court phone at this point. So you can't even see her, and she can't see them.
So Amber's come prepared, but she's having some problems. What's her plan for staying in her house?
So what Amber is really trying to get across is that she's tried to apply for federal CARES Act funding.
CARES Act, that's the huge federal relief package, right?
Yeah. And based on what I observed during the hearings, renters either had to show that they'd applied for CARES Act funding, or they had to fill out this form through the CDC that basically stated they'd been impacted by the pandemic, and they had to have given that to their landlord. But the problem is that some people either didn't know about that declaration form or didn't know about the assistance. And they'd come to court and they'd get asked, hey, did you apply for assistance? And they would say no, and they would explain that they have, in fact, been impacted by COVID, either through getting sick or losing their job, or getting their hours cut. But by that point, it was too late. But in Amber's case, she really did try to apply for that funding.
Do you have any application for rental assistance pending?
Yes, ma'am. I really do have an application, and I went through the CARES Act program for them to even pay up whatever I owe Mr. Gary, and I got an email from them actually this morning. They said my house wasn't registered through the city.
The rental assistance? The rental assistance told you that?
Yes, I got the email right here. It's in my phone.
Nora, what's happening here?
So this isn't something I encountered a lot, but for Amber, it's this really confusing and sort of pivotal moment. She's trying really hard to explain to the magistrate that she's tried to access this funding, but hasn't been able to. And it's because her landlord is not registered with the county. Like, the rental property is not registered.
So because her landlord didn't register his house properly, Amber can't get federal assistance?
Right. And the county instituted this rule basically stating that if you're not registered with the county, you cannot benefit from this federal funding.
She's an essential worker who lost income during the pandemic. She's working with COVID patients on top of that. She's exactly the kind of person the CDC doesn't want ending up homeless. But she can't access this federal program because her landlord didn't file the right paperwork?
It ultimately ends up punishing Amber rather than penalizing the landlord, who should have gotten his registration completed through the county.
So then what happens?
So there's some quick back and forth. It's a really confusing moment. Gary says he's never received any communication about the CARES Act, and the magistrate accepts his answer.
It'll be the judgment of the court that, based on the testimony that has been provided here today, a writ of restitution will be issued in favor of the plaintiff for failure to pay rent.
In less than 10 minutes, Amber loses her home. The moratorium failed to protect her.
Did you get to talk to Gary Thomas?
I did. I called Gary 3 times, and he told me he'd had enough problems with the city of Akron, and he wasn't interested in talking to us.
What about the magistrates? Did you ask why they were evicting people who should have been covered by the moratorium?
Yes. And one of them, Magistrate Jennifer Towle, basically told me that the CDC moratorium was difficult to understand. It was left to local jurisdictions to interpret, and it really didn't leave a lot of clarity on how to enforce it.
They're not written the best way possible as far as for the people who actually have to apply them. So first, you know, we have to interpret what our court, you know, what our interpretation is and how we are going to move forward with that. And sometimes there's attorneys or litigants who maybe don't agree with the court's interpretation of it, which is within their rights.
So if I understand the problem correctly, the CDC wanted to do this lofty, humane, and safe public health thing, which is protect tenants from eviction to stop the spread of COVID. But when they actually went to write the moratorium, they wrote it in such a way that, in Akron at least, magistrates had a lot of room to interpret what they meant, and that in turn left some people out.
Right, and it just didn't provide a lot of structure. And this really left court systems out in terms of figuring out how they were going to do this. And it left tenants out in figuring out how they could access the moratorium and prevent their eviction. And things were really messy for a really long time. And it seemed like just as we were getting into the flow of using this moratorium in a way that was uniform, landlord groups started to sue to stop the moratorium.
Did the landlords try to sue the CDC over this moratorium?
Yes. And actually, last March, a federal judge in Cleveland ruled that the CDC went beyond what the Public Health Service Act allows it to do. He didn't go as far as to stop it, but this is something that landlords have argued all along. They say they're hurting too because the aid they were supposed to receive was way too slow to come in, and it maybe brought funding in for 3 months, but there was no guarantee or consistency on how they were going to receive the next 3 months.
So this CDC plan was really well-intentioned, but when it came down to it, it was confusing to magistrates, confusing to landlords, confusing to tenants, and also didn't offer Amber the protection she thought she had. What's it been like for her since?
Well, it's been about 3 months since she's been evicted, but she's done a pretty good job of landing on her feet. She found a new place to live. She kept on with her GED and graduated, and she continued with courses at Stark State College.
It sounds like it worked out for Amber. Kind of surprising. I wasn't totally expecting a happy ending.
So, yeah, she does pretty well for herself. But, you know, that wasn't the case for everyone. I would attend these hearings, and then I would go visit people after their hearings that day and talk to them. Some were rushing to find a different place to live. Others were planning on splitting up their families and, you know, living at different friends and families' homes. And I even remember one man telling me that he may end up living in his car. There were some more hopeful cases like Amber's, but for the most part, eviction is really destabilizing for families and households, and almost everyone I spoke to were scrambling to find a new place to live.
Thanks so much for your reporting, Noor.
Thanks for having me, Ike.
That was Noor Hindi, who reported on this story for the Devil's Strip and the Home in Akron Reporting Collaboration. The story was produced by Amy Mustafa. Our next story takes us to Sacramento, California, where CAP Radio's Sarah Mizestan investigates another federal program that was supposed to help people during the pandemic.
The way that discrimination happens or racism happens is never by accident. It's either by design or it's baked into the system for, you know, generations.
You're listening to Reveal.
Reveal is brought to you by Progressive. Are you thinking more about how to tighten up your budget these days? Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average, and customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts when they sign up. A little off your rate each month goes a long way. Get a quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed in 2020. Potential savings will vary. Discounts vary and are not available in all states and situations.
Hi, I'm Emily Harris, a reporter and producer here at Reveal. We're a nonprofit newsroom, and we rely on support from listeners like you. To become a member, text the word REVEAL to 474747. Standard data rates apply, and you can text STOP at any time. Again, text REVEAL to 474747. Thank you for supporting the show.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja, in for Al Letson. We just heard about how the CDC's eviction moratorium didn't halt all evictions during the pandemic. And it wasn't the only federal plan that fell short of helping the people it was supposed to. Every Sunday, about 150 people would crowd into Vida Church, a Latino-led congregation in North Sacramento, California. They heard songs and sermons in Spanish and English, led by Pastor Alex Vaiz.
That means the presence of God needs to begin to overflow.
But for Vida Church, those days are over. Like many places of worship, it didn't survive the pandemic. The federal government was supposed to offer a safety net through the Paycheck Protection Program, which provided hundreds of billions of dollars to small businesses. Earlier this year, Reveal found that in major cities across the country, the rate of lending was higher in majority white neighborhoods than in neighborhoods of color. We shared our data with local reporters around the country, and Sarah Mizestan of CAP Radio in Sacramento found something else, that in her area, the disparity was even more pronounced for places of worship. Here's Sarah.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, good.
It's a sunny Saturday in June when I meet with Pastor Alex at this warehouse-style building where his church used to be.
It's just surreal because the last time I've been here was when we were taking everything out.
Vida Church didn't only have services. It also ran a food bank and held an annual harvest festival for the community. Now, it's much quieter than it used to be. Pastor Alex just came back here to meet me.
Some of the dreams that we had here, you know, we really wanted to connect with the community, serve the community's needs. You know, a big part, if not the gist of our faith, is to serve other people, to love people and serve people. Meet people where they're at, show them the love of God in tangible ways, not just, you know, come to my church.
This working class neighborhood is called Old North Sacramento. Some of the historic buildings from the 1900s are currently being revitalized. But it's also industrial, with a number of vacant lots and abandoned buildings mixed in with a few houses. Latinos are the largest ethnic group.
You know, it's been very underserved. It's been a forgotten community.
For Pastor Alex, this place represented a special calling, an opportunity for his church to make an impact. But when the pandemic hit, Pastor Alex had to stop holding services in person. No more community events either.
So our budget just fell all the way, you know, from down 60%, and then it continued to go further.
He tried moving services online, but people didn't show. Many parishioners lost their jobs. The congregation stopped giving. The church lost its lease.
It was devastating. It was very difficult because that's the biggest part of ministry. It's connecting with your people. They know you're there. They can go to you.
For many new immigrants, Vita Church was a home away from home, a place for them to get on their feet. So parishioners share Pastor Alex's sense of loss. Claudio Ramos Chile attended the church for 13 years until it closed.
The same feeling that I had leaving my family and my friends 30 years ago in El Salvador and feeling homesick about it, that's the way it felt. It felt like I left my family. It's painful not to, you know, gather, not to have that community with them.
But Vita Church didn't have to close. The Paycheck Protection Program was supposed to help small businesses and nonprofits with fewer than 500 employees. And that includes churches and other places of worship. The idea was to stabilize communities and keep people employed, even when they were ordered to stay home. But when we looked at the Sacramento area, we found a huge disparity. $20 million of government aid went to places of worship in majority white neighborhoods. That's three times as much as neighborhoods that are majority people of color. And that's despite the fact that Sacramento is pretty evenly split in terms of racial diversity. The Latino-led Vita Church in Old North Sacramento, they didn't even apply. Gabby Trejo runs Sacramento Area Congregations Together, a nonprofit interfaith organization.
The Latino faith leaders that lead much smaller congregations and are having to be the admin, the pastor, the counselor, the everything, it might have been more difficult for them to actually access these loans and be thinking about those loans as they were also serving families and individuals.
She says a lot of Latino-led congregations didn't have anyone with the financial background to apply for the Paycheck Protection Program. Even though the application was fairly short, to Pastor Alex and other leaders of Black and Latino and Asian congregations, they were worried it would be a complicated government program. African Americans and Latinos were the two racial groups most likely to lose their jobs during the pandemic. And so these congregations struggled as donations dwindled and parishioners lost their jobs.
It is frustrating because when we look at the numbers of who got the loans and we look at how Latino faith leaders were left out and, you know, African-American faith leaders were left out.
She says the way the PPP money was handed out is just one more example of how unevenly resources have been distributed in the community. Earlier this year, Reveal uncovered many factors that fueled these disparities for small businesses. Many business owners in Latino, Asian, and African-American communities lacked the computers and scanners they needed to send financial documents quickly to banks. Some business owners worried about taking out a loan in the middle of an economic crisis. And there was confusion about whether the smallest businesses, those without employees, qualified for PPP. The same confusion extended to churches.
It is disappointing and it is heartbreaking.
And the harm extends far beyond the closure of a place of worship. Gabby says religious institutions, especially in historically underserved neighborhoods like Old North Sacramento, play a crucial role in keeping communities together.
When we think about what congregations bring to our community, our faith leaders, they're in the trenches listening to these stories day in and day out, right? Like really providing that care for people, the spiritual care.
While churches in Latino neighborhoods were shutting their doors, some places of worship in the city's majority white neighborhoods were expanding. Here in Rosemont, a middle-class suburb, there are tree-lined streets with detached single-family homes and sprawling green lawns. At one of the churches here, Capital Christian Center, there's a big fountain right at the entrance. On Father's Day, the music was literally booming. A full brass band played during the morning service, and docents welcomed people in. Capital Christian Center received one of the largest loans to any religious institution in Sacramento, $1.7 million. Lane Alves is one of the pastors here. She says the loan was a huge help to the church. It allowed them to expand, even during the pandemic.
We hired a new worship leader during COVID. He just started in February of this year, actually. You know, the church is here to support in all ways. We say we're made up physically, spiritually, socially, and academically.
They were even able to open their private K-12 school in person.
That was a huge win for us.
Capital Christian is lucky, she says. They used their loan money to grow, but also to continue their community service work, like a monthly food drive. Their church had a whole financial team that managed its application for the Paycheck Protection Program. They got their money quickly, in the first round of federal funding, early in the pandemic. And then, what felt like another miracle for them. The loan was completely forgiven. All $1.7 million. That's not unusual. A lot of businesses and organizations that got money from PPP didn't have to pay it back. I reached out to the Small Business Administration to ask them why more wasn't done to help faith communities of color. No one would talk to me, but I eventually received a statement which said the federal government is deeply committed to getting money to struggling small businesses. So then I reached out to the banks. They handed out the government's money. Beth Mills is a spokesperson for the California Bankers Association.
I think if you look actually, you know, the numbers of the support that our members give to organizations in a lot of these communities, there's people who work in the branches that are in these communities, they live in the communities, they're very committed to supporting these communities. So I don't think that's representative all of the commitment that our banks have to these communities.
I pressed her. If race isn't a factor, how could it be that churches in Sacramento's white neighborhoods got three times as much money as those where people of color make up the majority?
I do wonder, like, is this just the definition of systemic racism?
You know, I mean, I think that unfortunately, maybe the applications didn't come in from certain ethnicities. And you know, so there might have been an ethnicity that had more applications in the door than others did. And I don't think that all speaks to characterizing a bank's intentions or with respect to especially racism.
If the banks say they're serving these communities, why was there such a huge disparity in the loans they received?
My name is Paulina Gonzalez Brito, and I'm the executive director of the California Reinvestment Coalition.
That's an advocacy organization that provides banking support to communities of color. She says it's no coincidence that congregations in white neighborhoods got a lot more money from the Paycheck Protection Program.
You know, this really is about the long history of relationships or a lack of relationships that financial institutions have had with Black, Indigenous, and people of color.
She says that legacy of discrimination put a responsibility on banks today.
The government or banks will say that, you know, these things just happen accidentally, that they're not in any way the way that they design programs, whether at the government level or at the financial institution level. And it's a way of washing their hands of responsibility
the way that discrimination happens or racism happens is never by accident. It's either by design or it's baked into the system for, you know, generations.
You can see the impact of those disparities here in North Sacramento, where Vita Church used to be. For Pastor Alex, standing in front of his shuttered church, the memories flood back.
We'd use all of that space for those large Halloween events. We'd fill it up with jump houses. It was really neat because people would come out from all the community and, you know, be able to, you know, hang out with us. A lot of things, a lot of memories.
Vita Church is still broke, but Pastor Alex is trying to get resources together so they can begin to hold services, first in people's homes and then hopefully at a more permanent location.
Sarah Mises-Tan is the race and equity reporter for CAP Radio in Sacramento. Her story was edited by Aaron Glantz and was part of a collaboration with CAP Radio and NPR's California Newsroom. The show was also edited by Brett Myers and Cynthia Rodriguez. Our production manager, Amy Mustafa, helped produce the show, and I was the lead producer this week. Reveal's Mohammed Al-Elu provided data analysis on our Akron eviction story. Grace Oldham helped out with additional research, and Nina Martin was the digital editor. Thanks to James Miller at the DuPont Manual Magnet High School in Louisville. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Score and sound design by Jim Briggs and Fernando Aruda. They had help this week from Stephen Rascone and Claire Mullen. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our interim CEO is Annie Schabel. Sumi Agrawal is our interim editor-in-chief. And our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Hellman Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja, and as always, Al would like you to remember, there is always more to the story.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. Meet Dan. Dan built a kick-ass bike company, but his old software made it impossible to keep up with demand. It took so much time just to make things work, it was sucking the life out of him. Then he found Odoo. Odoo automated his business by integrating inventory, manufacturing, accounting, and marketing. Now he can meet the demand and grow even faster with the e-commerce app. Thanks to Odoo, Dan doubled his revenue and can focus on what matters. Go to odoo.com/reveal to start a free trial. That's odoo.com/reveal.
From PRX.